It was Wesley Clark who said that, you know, we need an America where debate and dissent and questioning your leaders and holding them accountable is the highest form of patriotism. And it was J. William Fulbright who said that in a democracy, dissent is an act of faith. And it was Ari Fleischer who said that people have just got to watch what they say and do. Thanks again. America, is a 57 Chevy that veers to the left and lurches to the right. America is a pawn shop window with decals of Old Glory made by children in China. America is a dog playing poker, saying war is a last resort and wagging his tail. America is a compassionate conservative, a gay Republican, and a vegetarian vampire. America is that Norman Rockwell of the family on Thanksgiving hung on the wall of an Indian casino. America is a big group therapy session with one guy in the corner who will not shut up. Missouri, doing Louis Armstrong. America is a scholarly discussion of the socioeconomic implications of Janet Jackson's boob. Came up to you and said, I'm going to bring forth on this nation a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. You'd probably say, right on, good luck with that. And what if he said, I'm going to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Probably say, wow, knock yourself out. And what if he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You'd probably say, I got a meeting. America is a conspiracy of genius in sweat-stained waistcoats and powdered wings. America is a homeless Jesus being held at gunpoint by King James. America is an apple pie with a few bad apples right toward the top. America is a dream of freedom dreamed by everyone all over the world. Liberty and justice for all. That's nuts. Yeah, it just might work.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM if you're in the Sacramento area. Today's program is Automation, Inequality, and What to Do About It. Insights into the world where machines think and people don't. Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee talk about their book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. And they talk about the technological advancements that have taken over our lives, our economy, and suggest how do we deal with this.
I'm Andrew Leonard from Salon.com, your moderator for this evening's program. To my left is Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, who are business researchers at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Eric is the director of the MIT Center for Digital Business, and Andrew is the principal research scientist. The two men made a name for themselves a couple of years ago with their self-published book, Race Against the Machine, which kind of coalesced some emerging nervousness about the fact that automation is really beginning to replace jobs at higher and higher levels. They followed this up with a bigger book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. And it's really, I think everybody in this room will understand how timely this is. In the San Francisco and the Greater Bay Area, there's a lot of tension about both how the tech economy is changing everybody's lives and you know where we're headed from there. And The Second Machine Age directly tackles both the promise of technology and some potential challenges it poses. So I think both would like to start before questions with giving a brief kind of summary of their views. And that's, you know, what's The Second Machine Age all about?
Well, why don't I start and say that The Second Machine Age really got started from some confusion that both Andy and I had about what was going on in the world. On one hand, innovation has never been faster. But on the other hand, people have gotten more and more pessimistic about their futures and their children's futures. And reflects two different groups of people, two different tribes, really, that Andy and I interact with regularly. On one hand, there are technologists who are observing and in fact, creating just wondrous new things, self-driving cars and machines you can talk to and other amazing technologies. And they're almost infectiously optimistic about the potential of these technologies to transform the world. But we also spend a lot of time interacting with economists. And there's a reason they're called the dismal science. I just came from a meeting in Philadelphia, the American Economic Association meeting, and I was on a panel there with three other economists, and they were pointing out some pretty dismal statistics. As you may know, median income, the income of the person at the 50th percentile in America, is lower now than it was in the 1990s. And employment, of course, has been struggling as well. The employment to population ratio has plummeted. And while some of the unemployment numbers are a little bit better recently, that mostly reflects people dropping out of the labor force, not new jobs being created. And we were puzzled because we wanted to see how can, you know, these two groups with these very different perspectives, is one right and is one wrong? Or how could these facts be simultaneously apparent? And in fact, if you look deeper, it is true that there are some really impressive numbers that match up with the optimism of the technologists. Overall wealth in the U.S. economy just hit a record high, $77 trillion. We're at record levels of productivity. GDP is at record levels. Profits at record levels. All those numbers are growing quite steeply. But the other statistics about median income and unemployment are also exactly accurate. And ultimately, as we were working on this book, we came to the conclusion that it's possible for both these things to be happening simultaneously. It reflects the fact that technology does grow the economic pie. It does create more wealth. However, there's a sort of dirty secret of economics, and that is that there's simply no economic law that says everyone's going to benefit evenly from these technological advances. It's possible for some people to be made not just relatively worse off, but worse off in absolute terms. Now, in the first machine age, it was people like buggy whip manufacturers that were hurt by the introduction of the automobile. But today, it could be a much larger group of people, tens of millions of people, even potentially a majority of people that are having a harder time making a living than they did before. And understanding the nature of these causes and consequences and the central role of technology in driving both the bounty and the spreading out of outcomes is what we wrote this book about, and trying to understand the implications and what it means for individuals, for corporations, and for society is what we're hoping to refocus the conversation on.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
'49 was in Georgia's hell. A maggot band they called the Diggers came to show the people's well. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. "We come in peace," they said, "to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the wasteland grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it can be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No one has any right to buy and sell yet for private gain. By theft and murder they took the lands. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of grace who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroying their corn. They were dispersed, only the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. The earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the order came to cut them down.
And now, back to Eric Bryn Yolson and Andrew McAfee and Andrew Leonard.
Eric and I have spent our whole careers working at the intersection of technology and economics and doing research there. And as Eric says, we wrote this book because we got confused about both the economics and the technology. Eric has just described the economic paradox that was going on. Let me talk a little bit about the technology confusion that's going on. It's basically that technology has started, digital technologies have started doing things that they're not supposed to be able to do. The book's genesis for me started in the fall of 2010 when I was over breakfast, opened up my computer and started browsing the New York Times website and came across a story about the fact that Google had been driving, well, not Google, no one had been driving cars. The company had developed these autonomous cars that had at that point already driven thousands of miles on American roads in traffic with no mishaps. And I spit out my coffee at this point because they really weren't supposed to be able to do that. There was a wonderful book written just 6 years earlier, 2004, that Eric and I read. We talked about. The book made a really convincing, strong argument for why computers were really never going to be able to drive cars. And it was basically because the sensing, the pattern matching, the processing, all the stuff that you've got to do to do that well is pretty easy for us and our brains, prohibitively difficult for computers. And Eric and I read that book in 2004. We nodded our heads at each other. 6 years later, they're already driving cars. You see similar weirdness happening in a bunch of other really difficult problems that have bedeviled computer scientists and roboticists and other people. We're going to do a pop quiz. It's going to be really, really easy. Everyone, point to a door in this room. This is a smart crowd. Okay, here's an even weirder question. Point to where you are in this room. Yeah, and there's this nice dichotomy. Some folk go like this and some go like, they're both correct answers. We'll accept both of them. My point is, you have just solved one of the thorniest challenges in robotics. It's called SLAM, simultaneous localization and mapping. What does this room look like? Where are the doors? And where am I in this room? We are really good at that. You saw what an ace crowd we have. That program, that problem has basically prohibited progress in robotics. You put a robot in a room and ask him where he is and where the door, I'm sorry, he or she is and where the door is, and you just watch the shenanigans take place. As recently as 2008, there was a review of the literature that said, look, we've made no progress in SLAM, nor will we, because it's just too dang hard to do. Last year, a colleague of ours at MIT, a guy named John Leonard, solved the SLAM problem for a room about this size by waving a Microsoft Kinect around in it. This is a $150 piece of consumer electronics. So Eric and I saw enough examples like that, and we said, what on earth is going on here? And led us to go out and talk to a lot of the nerds, both on the economic side and the technology side, and eventually led to this book.
Well, I think the first question that one would want answered then is how and why this happened. We've been hearing promises, especially here, where we're just north of where all these things get made, of things that are going to change the world, artificial intelligence is going to solve all our problems, and these promises are regularly not delivered on.
Yep.
And now, in the last 3 or 4 years, something seems to have changed.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Can we give you a three-part answer to that question? Because that was really what sent us into the field. Our answer to that takes up about the first third of the book, and there's really a three-part answer.
But you're only going to have to do it in just a couple of minutes here.
Right, but I'll save you some time. It's a three-part answer. The first part is the relentless improvement in computing power that most of us know of as Moore's Law. And it is really easy to underestimate what happens when this doubling, when this exponential improvement has been going on long enough. Sometimes a difference in degree really is a difference in kind, and we think we're at that point when the smartphone that most of us, probably all of us, are carrying around in our pockets tonight is literally the supercomputer of a generation ago. You just have enough horsepower to do some extraordinarily difficult things. Part two of the answer is, we're probably all tired of the phrase, but big data. This ocean of digital information that we are swimming in. It's not orders of magnitude bigger than it was 5 or 10 years ago. It's thousands, millions, billions of times greater than it was 5 or 10 years ago. The reason that's tremendously important is that data is the lifeblood of science. And if you want to get smarter about a real world problem, you need scads of data. We've got scads of data. And then finally, the third part of our three-part answer is that real innovation, coming up with something new, is not this process of a lone eureka. It's a process of recombining building blocks that are already out there. The Google driverless car is a great example. It's an internal combustion engine, plus a LiDAR sensor, plus a GPS system, plus a bunch of processing power. Google invented none of those things. They just recombined the building blocks that were already there. And our world has so many more building blocks in it now than it did even a short time ago, that's giving us this wave of innovation that we're seeing. So our shorthand answer, Andrew, to your question of why now, exponential, digital, combinatorial. A chapter is devoted to
That's
each
right.
of those.
I have one question up here so far, which I think touches a little bit on that. It's, what do the stagnation and end of innovation folks not recognize when they're faced with that? I mean, he cites Tyler Cohen,
yep.
Yeah. Who has coined this term, the great stagnation, in which his argument is that growth has kind of reached
right.
this
yeah. plateau.
This plateau, and you're painting a quite different mm-hmm. picture.
Well, Tyler's a super smart guy, and we've discussed this with him, and we owe him a debt because he really inspired us to work on that first book, Race Against the Machine, when we read his book, because he was arguing that we had run out of innovations and that there was just no more good things or few good things left to invent. And hanging around places like the MIT Media Lab and CSAIL or Silicon Valley, we just thought, well, that can't possibly be true.
Is this guy looking at the same economy we're looking at, was the question we had.
But on the other hand, he had some very compelling data about about the stagnation of median income, and that's really forced us to think hard about how this could be happening. And that's where we came up with this recognition that just because median income is stagnating, that doesn't mean innovation is stagnating. In fact, paradoxically, if innovation speeds up, that can be lead to a lot of people falling behind if they're not keeping up with their skills or if the organizations are not keeping up. And this dramatic reorganization of the economy can simultaneously be a symptom of great innovation and wealth creation, but also lead to stagnating median income. And it relates to a fundamentally different worldview that we had than he had, which is that innovations, we don't think of them as low-hanging fruit. That's the metaphor that he uses, that, as he says, we've plucked most of the low-hanging fruit, and as you pluck low-hanging fruit, it gets harder and harder to get new innovations. As Andy just explained, innovations don't get used up that way. In fact, each innovation creates building blocks for additional innovations, whether it's the Google self-driving car or really, you know, trivial but I think illustrative example is I had a student, undergraduate student, and he wrote this little app in a few weeks. And with a few months later, there were 1.3 million users using it. And he didn't do any like brilliant breakthroughs through it, but the reason that his app was able to scale so rapidly was because he built it on top of Facebook. And Facebook was built on top of the World Wide Web. And the web is built on the internet, which is built on networking, electricity, you could go on and on. But each of those innovations didn't make it harder for somebody else to make a subsequent innovation. They made it easier for someone to make an innovation. So the low-hanging fruit metaphor, I think, is exactly the wrong one for the nature of innovation. And we're lucky it is, because that means that we are getting more building blocks for additional innovations and more potential for additional growth.
I have 422 friends, yet I'm lonely. I speak to all of them every day, yet none of them really know me. The problem I have sits in the spaces between, looking into their eyes or at a name on a screen. I took a step back and opened my eyes. I looked around and realised that this media we call social is anything but when we open our computers and it's our doors we shut. All this technology we have, it's just an illusion. Community, companionship, a sense of inclusion. Yet when you step away from this device of delusion, you awaken to see a world of confusion. A world where we're slaves to the technology we mastered, where information gets sold by some rich, greedy bastard. A world of self-interest, self-image, self-promotion, where we all share our best bits but leave out the emotion. We're at our most happy with an experience we share, but is it the same if no one is there? Be there for your friends, and they'll be there too, but no one will be if a group message will do. We edit and exaggerate, crave adulation. We pretend not to notice the social isolation. We put our words into order until our lives are glistening. We don't even know if anyone is listening. Being alone isn't a problem. Let me just emphasise, if you read a book, paint a picture, or do some exercise, you're being productive and present, not reserved and recluse. You're being awake and attentive and putting your time to good use. So when you're in public and you start to feel alone, put your hands behind your head, step away from the phone. You don't need to stare at your menu or at your contact list. Just talk to one another. Learn to coexist. I can't stand to hear the silence of a busy commuter train where no one wants to talk through the fear of looking insane. We're becoming unsocial. It no longer satisfies to engage with one another and look into someone's eyes. We're surrounded by children who, since they were born, have watched us living like robots and think it's the norm. It's not very likely you'll make world's greatest dad if you can't entertain a child without using an iPad. When I was a child, I'd never be home. Be out with my friends on our bikes we would roam. I'd wear holes in my trainers and graze up my knees. We'd build our own clubhouse high up in the trees. Now the park's so quiet it gives me a chill. See no children outside and the swings hanging still. There's no skipping, no hopscotch, no church and no steeple. We're a generation of idiots, smartphones and dumb people. So look up from your phone, shut down the display. Take in your surroundings, make the most of today. Just one real connection is all it can take to show you the difference that being there can make. Be there in the moment that she gives you the look that you remember forever as when love overtook. The time she first holds your hand or first kiss your lips. The time you first disagree but still love her to bits. The time you don't have to tell hundreds of what you've just done because you want to share this moment with just this one. The time you sell your computer so you can buy a ring for the girl of your dreams who is now the real thing. The time you want to start a family and the moment when you first hold your little girl and get to fall in love again. The time she keeps you up at night and all you want is rest and the time you wipe away the tears as your baby flees the nest. The time your baby girl returns with a boy for you to hold, and the time he calls you granddad and makes you feel real old. The time you take in all you've made just by giving life attention, and how you're glad you didn't waste it by looking down at some invention. The time you hold your wife's hand, sit down beside her bed, you tell her that you love her, lay a kiss upon her head. She then whispers to you quietly, as her heart gives a final beat, that she's lucky she got stopped by that lost boy in the street. But none of these times ever happened. You never had any of this. When you're too busy looking down, you don't see the chances you miss. So look up from your phone, shut down those displays. We have a finite existence, a set number of days. Don't waste your life getting caught in the net, as when the end comes, nothing's worse than regret. I'm guilty too of being part of this machine, this digital world we are heard but not seen, where we type as we talk and we read as we chat, where we spend hours together without making eye contact. So don't give in to a life where you follow the hype. Give people your love, don't give them your like. Disconnect from the need to be heard and defined. Go out into the world, leave distractions behind. Look up from your phone, shut down that display. Stop watching this video, live life the real way.
And now for something completely different.